Welcome everyone to the 12th episode of the Board Game OK podcast, a podcast about board games and the hobby of board gaming, recorded in sunny and actually warm-ish Helsinki, Finland. I'm one of your hosts, Luis, and with me is your other host, Jonas.
Terve.
In this episode, we will be discussing everything about the perfect board game cafe or board game venue. Doesn't have to be a cafe, can be a bar. What do we like to see at a place that curates for board gamers? And what we would consider if we were planning to set one of these ourselves as a business. But before we get to that, we will review three games: Bottle Imp, Harmonies, and Hanami Koji. Jonas, why don't you tell us more about Bottle Imp?
Bottle Imp is a three-player trick-taker from 1995 that got a new release from Matako last year. Well, I shouldn't say a three-player trick-taker because the new version plays up to six players. But the game is mostly known as a three-player trick-taker, and I've only played the game at three players. The basic elements of Bottle Imp are the following. There are three suits and only one card for each number, ranging from 1 to 37. You must follow the lead suit, but you don't need to play the lead suit in order to win the trick. The thing that makes Bottle Imp is the Bottle Imp, which in my copy of the game is a wooden bottle that gets passed around during the hand. If you are the one holding the bottle at the end of a round, you score minus points while others score positive points. The bottle always starts with the value of 19 and isn't owned by any one player. The first time someone plays a card that's below 19, the bottle becomes the property of that player and the value of the bottle is changed to the card that the player played. So if I play an 11, I get the bottle, and the next time someone plays a card below 11, I give the bottle to them. So, if you have the card 1 in your hand, does it mean that you will eventually be the last person holding the bottle? Not necessarily. If multiple people play below the current value of the bottle, only the player who played the highest card below the value gets the bottle. So, if the bottle value is 19 and the player before you plays 18, you can safely play any card below the bottle price because the new value will be 18. In the beginning of the game, you will also pass one card to the player to your left, one card to the player to your right, and one card to the middle, which will be the imp's trick, or the negative points the player with the bottle has to take at the end of a round. I've heard some people call Bottle Imp a family weight trick taker, but I honestly think that while you might get people to understand the rules, there's quite a bit of strategy that needs to be internalized before you can play the hands you're dealt effectively. And while you might think that Bottle Imp sounds like a fun game of hot potato, it doesn't play like that if you don't know how to play the table. Or at least this was my experience in my first place. The game can easily feel like the loser is just always the player who ends up with the lowest cards in their hand. Luis, I played Bottle Imp for the first time with you last year. What did you think of the game?
I remember not liking it at all the first time we played it. And I think I played it again with you afterwards, like a second time, not on that same session.
No.
Have we only played it one time?
We have only played it one time.
Then I think I have played it a second time with somebody else. Because I remember the first time that I played it not liking it at all. Like feeling like, there's like, it's too random. It's like, too luck dependent, the distribution of the cards is kind of weird. Kind of like things finally clicked on that second time where like I see what you need to do in order to get the strategy. Like it's definitely something that even if you understand trick taking, it's not your classic trick taking strategies that will help you succeed.
Nope. Yeah. In our first game, I had an interesting personal arc in that game. First, I didn't know what to do. Then I kind of got the hang of the game and was able to make a couple good moves. But then you and the other player clearly got the hang of it also. And then it started feeling like a bad hand is a bad hand and there's nothing you can do about it. I played after that the game also with family. After one hand, Chilla and her mom, who I played with, they were like, please, let's play something else because this game doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
I heard also other podcasts having a pretty meh time with Bottle Imp. So it really felt like, okay, this is not just me. I'm not the only one having these bad experiences with the game.
Yeah.
So yeah, I was getting very ready to get rid of the game. But I also kept hearing how some people really like the game. Mm-hmm. So I kind of wanted to give it one more chance. So a couple of weeks ago, I had a three-player game day, and after Food Chain Magnate, I suggested that we would play Bottle Imp. And at this one specific point of our game of Bottle Imp, I had an aha moment of sorts. The distribution of the suits, it's not equal. In my copy, the suits are red, blue, and yellow. Most of the reds are very high, and most of the yellows very low. Mm-hmm. There is a player reference for the distribution of the cards, which makes this thing very apparent to all players. But the thing I had not paid attention to was that only three yellow cards are higher than the starting price of the bottle, which is 19. And I happened to have two of those cards in my hand, which meant that only one of my opponents had a yellow card that's higher than 19, and the other opponent had only yellows that are below 19. Mm-hmm. I also had the yellow one in my hand, the absolute worst card in the game. Mm-hmm. But if I led with that yellow one, I would be completely safe because my other opponent had no choice but to play a yellow that was below 19 because I knew that none of their yellows are higher than 19. Mm-hmm. Meaning they had to take the bottle and I got rid of my one. Easy peasy. And that moment was like my personal big brain moment in Bottle Imp. Mm-hmm. After that, I started card counting the yellows to know when I could safely throw away my lower cards. Then I noticed that in order for me to have that flexibility of waiting for the right moment to throw cards away, I had to be able to play off suit, which meant that I wasn't anymore passing just my absolute lowest cards, but sometimes cards that were higher, but in suits I wanted to get rid of. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I'm not an expert in Bottle Imp yet, but I now feel as if the curtains were opened in front of me and I got a glimpse of how much strategic play there is in Bottle Imp.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what happened also the second time I played it. I enjoyed it a bit more because I understood the strategy a bit better. I haven't played it enough to be like a master Bottle Imper. So I also like, it's one of those games that, yeah, I can for sure play. I understand why people like it and why some people say, uh-huh, but I completely understand why all the people are like, nah, this does not make sense. The first games, which I think is, at least from what you're saying, the same arc that you went and the same similar arc that I went. I think I haven't gone into like, I love this game, but yeah.
I think sometimes you can't just get a hand that, you know, will leave you with the bottle in the end, mm-hmm. but you never actually take that many negative points if people pass those low cards to Imp's trick. It's usually -5 or -6 points, but the positive points can be over 50 if you are really raking in the points. Mm. So, if you get a truly awful deal, I think you need to start winning those tricks from the get-go, which means that you need to bring down the price of the bottle in a controlled manner while like always playing just below the bottle's value, mm-hmm. which leaves room for strategic play. Even if you know that you will be losing this round, you are only playing defense, but you can still kind of like prevent other people from getting a big lead.
Yeah, definitely.
I want to talk a little bit about the player count. I've only played Bottle Imp at 3, and I will only play this game at 3 in the future as well. You don't really have control when you are in the middle, meaning you don't lead the trick and you're not the last one to play a card to the trick. The more people you will have, the more people you will have between the first and the last player. You also pass to your left and to your right, which means that you know for sure at least one card that your opponents have in their hands. And this is a huge thing in a game like this, where card counting is super important and it's really important to know if people have a card that's slightly higher than you. So I can only see the game getting worse with every new player past 3, and now the game can go to 6. There are so many great trick takers for 4 players, even for 5 and 6, although not as many. So I would always just pick something else over Bottle Imp for those player counts, because I want that super tight trick taking experience whenever I get Bottle Imp to the table.
Jonas, I think you love trick-taking games in general. If you had to have a top 5 of trick-taking games, would this game make it to a top 5 collection?
I'm really looking forward to my next play. Like, I can't stop thinking about this particular game. And I've played plenty of trick-takers, so I don't know if I can give any higher praise than this for Bottle Imp. I'm not going to give you my top 5 trick-takers. But yeah, when it comes to recommending Bottle Imp specifically, be prepared for those first games to be flops and only play the game at 3. But if you're okay with all of that, then go for it. It's an easy, super easy recommendation from me. One thing I do also want to say in the end is that the rules in my version do not specify how long you should play the game. This is a game I want to play 6 hands off, so everyone gets to deal twice. One round of dealing feels way too little, because with three rounds it can easily happen so that one player never gets that truly awful hand and has to play it defensively. Which means don't take this game out if you want a quick 15-minute trick taker. Give Bottle Imp the 30 or 45 minutes that it deserves. That was Bottle Imp by Günther Kornet.
Now I'm going to talk about Harmonies. I've been playing Harmonies in Board Game Arena lately. Harmonies is a game from 2024 designed by Johan Benvenuto. It's a game for 1 to 4 players. I haven't played it solo. I have played with 2 to 4 players this game. Harmonies is a simple strategic board game where you are creating ecosystems with habitats and animals. The way you play this game is that basically you have a board with 5 sets of 3 tokens that are randomly distributed. Players most carefully choose the token set, considering both immediate placement opportunities and long-term habitat developments. Why? Because each one of these tokens represents a different habitat type. For example, you have brown tokens which represent wood, green tokens represent foliage and vegetation, gray tokens that represent rocks, red tokens houses or structures, yellow tokens are fields, and blue tokens represent water. So you have these 6 different color tokens. Each token has a specific and unique stacking rules. For example, green tokens can be put on top of brown tokens to create trees, but brown tokens cannot be put on top of green tokens. Red tokens can be put on top of brown, gray, or red cubes, but then you can only have one red token stock placed on top of another token. You cannot have multi-levels, while mountains and trees can go up to 3-level tokens. The other part of this game is that where you have animals that you are choosing from a board in the middle. In your turn, you don't have to, but you can optionally take an animal card, and each animal card will have a specific number of cubes in the card, which is the number of times that that animal can exist in your habitat, and each cube will have a number of points that it will give you. Basically, the easier it is, the more cubes it will have. For example, a frog might require a green token next to a blue token, and this is very thematic. Like, the frog needs to live in like these little lily pads, which is like the green token, which represents the vegetation, and next to the frog is in the water, so it's right next to the water. A bee needs a small tree, which is like a green token on top of a brown token, but it's surrounded by 3 valley tokens. So it's like, you imagine that the bee is taking the flower, the pollen from the flower, and so on and so forth. Like, there is an otter that is like a combination of green and blues. There is a salmon, which is like a mountain and some water, and so on and so forth. When the players create the correct habitats that are represented in the animal cards, they can place animal cubes. And once you have a cube, you cannot place anything else on top of that token. At the end of the game, you will score in 2 main ways. You will check your highest uncovered points on all of your animal cards. If you have uncovered all of the cube sections, then you have like the highest card. But if you haven't uncovered all of them, then you just check which one is the one that is the highest. And then each habitat configuration will have different points. So for example, the trees, each level of trees gives you a different amount of points. Each level of mountains gives you a different amount of points, but only if you have at least 2 mountain sections together. If they are alone, they will give you no points. Same with valleys. Each cluster of valleys will give you 5 points, but only if you have at least a cluster of 2 or more. Depending on the side of the board that you play, each one will have a little bit different scoring configuration. The game is often compared to Cascadia in the sense that you have the habitats, which also in Cascadia you have it, but in Cascadia you have hexagonal tiles, here you have tokens, and then you have the animals. In Cascadia you have animal tokens that are very specific, here you have cubes, and then the cubes come from the specific cards that you select. Also, people have said that it's a little bit like Azul because you have like the random tiles that are like that add the element of luck that you don't really get to select specifically what you want, but you get to select a combination and you have to use them the best you can. Like sometimes the tree, you really want 2 of them, but one of the 3 is kind of not something you want, but you still have to place it in your habitat. The game ends when either all of the tokens for the different habitats are gone or when one person has 2 or less hexagons in their board, empty only. So when they have mostly filled their board. I think this game, while being super easy and super cute and like I think it's family friendly, it's a bit harder than both Azul and Cascadia to introduce to new players.
Absolutely.
Because first of all, the first times I played this, I didn't do that good. I was playing with people that had more experience and they probably knew the game a bit better. And knowing the different configurations that you can have on those animal cards, I think is fundamental to doing well in this game. If you don't know what a type of animal you can expect, or if you don't know what type of animal there is still available for you to take in later turns, you might be messing up your board without really knowing. However, the more you play, it's only 32 different animal cards, so it's like relatively easy to remember the different configurations or most of them. And the more you play, I think, the more you can start preparing for future turns and start planning forward. And the more you play, you also understand, okay, you can maybe easier be like, okay, this particular set of three is not very good for me to take at the beginning because it might limit my options in the future of what I can make points with. However, on the other hand, I think it's like really nice to see. Like I personally think it looks better on the table than both Cascadia or Azul, which means that I think people will be enamored by just like the graphics and the gameplay a bit more than those other games, though it might be harder to play and might be harder to do well. But I don't think that matters that much because it's a game that is like easy enough, fast enough that you can quickly play a couple of games and then maybe get better at it at the end. Jonas, have you played this game?
I have played it on Board Game Arena. I don't have a physical copy. Do you think you're going to get a physical copy to play at home?
I don't know. I think this is one of those games that because it's somewhat replayable because of the different game cards, it's also like feels that as Cascadia or Azul, a game that I could easily get bored of, that I would like to play maybe once every 6 months or something like that, or I would like to use to introduce people to the hobby, but I would not necessarily own. So I don't think I will own it myself. However, I might buy a copy for the collection that we have at the office. I am the board game curator at the office, and I think this is a game that people would enjoy quite a lot and would like to take home for vacations or stuff like that, which is what people do with the board games that we have at the office. So I think that might be a reason to purchase it. But other than that, I would not get it myself.
These types of games, I personally don't wish to play every 6 months or so. I want to binge these types of games, you know, play a lot with Chilla and then just forget about it.
Yeah.
You know, I would love there to be this subscription service for like these type of special puzzles. You know, you give me one new game every month and then I swap it with the previous month's game and I always have like something fresh at home. Like we have Cascadia at home and we have had it now for some time. And I feel like I've definitely gotten my money's worth.
Yeah.
But these days, we're not really picking it from the shelf anymore. And I think it's because me and Chilla are, we're just over Cascadia. Like, we want something new. Mm-hmm. The puzzle is still fun. It's just like, come on, new animals, new graphics, some kind of new puzzle. That's what we want, a new puzzle.
Yeah. And I think this game would be a perfect replacement. But then if you could just swap it, as you say, with a subscription or with somebody else, I think this game would be the perfect replacement for that type of game. Yeah. So indeed, I feel the same. It's like a game that I could get from the library or buy from for the office, but I would personally not invest my money on that type of game anymore.
The reason why I haven't hit the buy button is, well, you said that people like the graphics, and I know people like the graphics. A lot of people like this style. But to me, the setting is just kind of super weird. Like you have all of these ecosystems mixed together. You have lions living with otters and with parrots or whatnot. And then the art of the game, it just makes the animals have this kind of like a Pokemon-esque feel to them. Like, I can tell that these are animals, but also, are these animals from cartoons or are they like superpowered or are they magical or something? Like, look at the lion on the cover.
Yeah.
Is that a lion or is it a Pokemon? I don't understand what's going on.
Yeah, for sure. It feels like a Pokemon.
Yeah, and because of that, I would rather have a pure abstract theme for this game instead of this current setting. But again, I understand the beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and a lot of people do like this style. So, you know, if you like it, hey, you're in for a treat. But for me, because of the style, it's an easier pass.
Yeah, but for sure, I think this could be a great game to, if you find it in a board game collection, in a board game cafe, like we were talking, to introduce new board gamers to the hobby. People that have already played maybe the Catans, the Azuls, is like, hey, let's try this one now. So like to get people that are kind of wanting to explore new board game mechanics to board gaming. That is it. That is Harmonies, a game by Johan Benvenuto. Now I'm going to talk about Hanami Koji. Hanami Koji is a strategic two-player card game from 2013 designed by Kota Nakayama. This is one of the first big renowned two-player games that came out, I think, or that made a name for themselves. And for a long time, it was very hard for me to track this game. I now own a copy of Hanami Koji, but I think they have reprinted it. It's way easier to get right now. But for a long time, I was like, it was one of the games that I wanted to get and just couldn't find it anywhere. But anyway, like the game is pretty simple. It's a strategic card game, as I said. You are competing to win the favor of geishas in Japan. And the way you do this is that each geisha has a number, a value, which both represent their score points and the number of cards that that geisha's color has in the deck. There is 21 cards, and there is 3 number 2 geishas, 2 number 3, 1 number 4, and 1 number 5. The way you win the favor of the geishas is that you're going to play cards in front of the geishas through different actions, which I'll mention in a second. And at the end of the round, whoever has the most cards in front of that geisha on their side will win the favor of the geisha. So you can imagine that for a geisha that has value 2, it's a bit easier to control, because if you have both cards in your hand, then you know that your opponent does not have any cards on their hand. Or if you already have one of them, you kind of know that it's less likely that your opponent will get the other card. On the other hand, the geisha with value 5, you might have one or even two cards from that geisha, but that means that there's still 3 cards available in the deck that your opponent may have. So it's a bit harder to make sure that you have the favor of that geisha. The way the game plays is that you have 6 cards in your hand. At the start of your every single turn, you will draw an additional card from the deck. So you will have 7 cards, and you will take one of these 4 actions, and these very specific actions, in any order that you want. You can either place a card face down for yourself that you will reveal at the end of the round. You will discard 2 cards that your opponent will never see until the end of the round. Then there is gift cards, which basically you put 3 cards face up, your opponent chooses 1, and you keep the other 2. And then the competition, which is called the action, which is like you basically split in 2 sets of 2 cards, and your opponent chooses 1, and you keep the other 1. So I split, you choose type of mechanic there. You have to take every single one of these actions, and your opponent will do the same. So based on that, you have to consider what are your strategic options in order to know which cards to put face down, in order to kind of reveal at the last minute, which cards to discard, and which cards to start like kind of playing for. At the end of the round, if you have the favor of 4 geishas or 11 points of geishas, so for example, if you win the favor of only 3 geishas, but they're the 2 level 3 and the level 5, which is the total is 11, then you win the game. This is a very simple game to play, a very engaging game, I think a very fantastic game, a strategic game. It's also a game that plays quite fast. It's quite tense also, because you're making these decisions. You don't know what your opponent is going to do, and you also don't know what you're going to get from the deck. Jonas, have you played this game?
I have played this game. But before I get to my opinions, here's a question to you.
Yeah.
What's your favorite opening in Hanamikoji?
My favorite opening in Hanamikoji really depends on the cards that I have. Mm-hmm. But I think in general, I would have like either the secret or the discard, like something that my opponent doesn't know. But I think it really depends. I try to keep the I split you choose action to the end of the game, at the end of the round, most cases. But again, it really depends on what cards you have in your hand to know, like, okay, what's my options? What is your favorite opening?
I can't remember anymore. It's been some time since I last played it. I think I might have had 5 plus games, something between 5 and 10 games of Hanamikoji.
Yeah, I think like, again, depends on your cards. The gift cards can be quite easy to kind of get rid of that one, because...
And what is the gift card?
A gift card, or sorry, I don't remember what the name of the action is, but like you put 3, your opponent takes 1, and you take 2.
Yeah.
That can be easy to just like, hey, I don't care, just choose 1. Or even like if you have, in later rounds, for example, if you already have favors of some of the geishas and you have cards, maybe you would open with like the 2 and the I split you choose. But on the very first round, I tend to leave that till the end. So, but I don't know.
My brain is also not built for this game.
No?
I feel like every time I won, it just felt that, okay, I got lucky this time. And every other time it's been like, it just feels like my opponents always know what to do, like so much better.
Yeah, but I think this game, the first time you play it, the first maybe few times you play it, it's like you really don't know what to do. But I think the more you play it, you start getting like, okay, if I have these cards, okay, if I have these 2, and maybe I can discard it, so I know that it's out of the game, so maybe I will lose the favor of that geisha. But also, if I get the other 2, then I know for a fact that is that geisha is mine. For example, in the geishas of level 2. Or something like that. I don't know. I think it's a very nice game. I like it quite a lot.
I had to go to Board Game Arena to check my stats, because I played this in real life only with you that one time. On Board Game Arena, I played it 13 times. I have 3 wins out of those 13.
Okay, so you have played more than 10 times. But yeah, I think also like in Board Game Arena, I think I've never played this game in Board Game Arena. I've just played it live. And it's one of those games that in Board Game Arena can go super fast.
Yeah.
That you maybe don't even care. But if you have like a rivalry with a friend, or like if you really want to win, it's one of those that can make it really tense. I think in Board Game Arena, when you don't know your opponent, it might be easier to be like, hey, I don't care if I win or I lose.
No, it's been tense for me.
Yeah, okay.
Because I've been trying to play it like I want to crack this game. Like, like I want to figure this game out. So even though if I don't know my opponent, I'm like thinking like, what do they know that I don't know? Like, what action should I take first?
Yeah.
I feel like every action I take, I'm like, oh no, I should have taken something else. Or like, no, all of the actions are bad actions.
Yeah. For sure, I have not played this enough to be a master of Hanami Koji. Maybe I have. I don't, you know, I don't record my plays, but maybe I have 20 plays of Hanami Koji under my belt. It's one of those games that also, if I'm only playing with a non-board gamer friend, it's easy to also introduce and to get them to understand the game. So it's a game that is easy to travel also if you're only playing with one other person and doesn't require a lot of investment like an Undaunted or another game that might put some people off. So I think this theme and this card game, it's quite easy for people to enjoy, at least in my opinion and in general.
By the way, about the theme.
Yeah.
About the theme. So, Luis, when you play Hanami Koji, who do you think you are? And what do you want in life when you are trying to get favors from geishas?
I think I am a businessman that wants some company. Whatever that may mean, it's like I am a rich businessman that I want either company or I want to be maybe the patron benefactor of these geishas. And then eventually I will enjoy the pleasure of their company, whatever that means.
Why did they pick this theme?
I do not know.
Yeah, because it's a bit of a weird theme. And I feel like it's just like a theme that prevents it from really entering into that, you know, two-player family game category.
Yeah. I don't know. Have you ever played the other versions or like the second edition of this game, like the Geisha's Road or other games like that?
Nope,
maybe they fixed this with those games.
With the Geisha's Road.
Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. Now...
No, but maybe it's just like, yeah, now you don't want the favor of the geisha, you just want to...
Now you want to what?
Maybe just to make them happy, or like you give them food, or like you're, I don't know.
With like no strings attached.
Yeah, no strings attached. I don't know. Maybe. I have no clue. Who could afford geishas back in the day? I think that's who you are representing.
Yeah.
All right, so that was Hanami Koji. Now we're going to talk about the perfect board game cafe, or the perfect board game venue if it's not a cafe, what we would like to consider if we were ourselves going to set one up specifically here in Helsinki, Finland. And we're just going to go over some of our opinions. This is nothing important. So Jonas, I actually, through the research for this episode, I ended up watching a bunch of videos from a company called Snake and Lattice, which is a company in Canada and the United States. And they have a video series that apparently they created in order to cater for people that had these specific questions. I think the series came out from them being annoyed at like having so many questions asked. They said like in the very first videos, like a lot of people have been sending us emails and coming to the Snake and Lattice place to ask us like how to make a board game bar, board game cafe venue successful. So I'm going to be asking you the questions, and then I'm going to be telling you at least what I learned from these videos. I didn't watch absolutely all the videos, but I watched some of them so we can get some information from them.
Also, you have worked in restaurants before, right? So you have like a little bit of insider information. I have never worked in a restaurant a day in my life.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I have a little bit of insider information. I think the business of a board game cafe might be quite different than just making a successful business for like a restaurant or a bar. I think there's some very specific intricacies into that, which we're going to talk about now. So first of all, what is your favorite place that you've ever visited that is either a board game cafe or a board game bar?
I don't know if I have a favorite. We talked about Trots, that is in London, that me and Chilla, we went to kind of check it out, but we didn't play there anything. You know, we were just passing through it and, you know, we took a peek. But I don't think I've ever been to a board game cafe where I felt that, oh, this is such a nice place. Oftentimes I've seen more things that are not perfect or are not kind of like, maybe up to my standards that I expect from of these type of places.
All right. First, let's talk about location. Where should the board game cafe be located?
You are not just meeting a single person for drinks, but instead meeting with multiple people. So there's a little bit of, you know, calendar admin that is involved. So, for example, if the place would be in Helsinki, I would hope that the place would be somewhere that's more or less a transportation hub. Because, you know, I have like friends living all over the capital region. So those would be the places where it's easier to come together.
Correct. And this is also what Snake and Lattice mentioned. That's actually the very first video. It's about location. You want a place where it's like close to a transportation center. You don't want a place that is far to reach because otherwise people will not get there. And ideally, you also want a place that is already known for being a kind of a bar, restaurant area, like a place also that has a lot of foot traffic so that people that are not necessarily hobby board gamers will also come there and visit. And then that will grow your business. So that is definitely something to consider. Put it in a highly trafficked area that is known for their other hip places. Now, they also mention about size of the city, of the location that you want to put. Like, obviously, if you live in a very small town, then maybe there's no point having it. They mention like, hey, well, maybe if there's already universities or places with students tend to like board games. And they mention like, if there's already stores that sell board gamers, then that means that there are board gamers in the area. And the more stores that sell board games in the area, then that means the more board games are potentially coming to your cafe.
Yeah, because I can imagine here in Finland, Helsinki can easily have multiple board game cafes. But my home city, Salo, in Finland, it has like 50,000 people living there, like around the city area. There's no way there's room for a board game cafe there.
No. And I think the only thing to consider if you wanted to make a business successful in a more remote location, it would be like a board game oriented hotel or something like that. I've heard about those, like where you just go play board games and then you have like, it's a destination.
Wow, that actually sounds amazing.
We're not going to explore that now, but like, I think indeed, like you need to have it in a city. It cannot be a small town. All right, what should be the size of the place for you, Jonas?
Yeah, I thought about this and I don't know what the size should be. First, I thought about like, you know, big enough so I can fit there and with my friends. But then I started thinking about all the things that you have to take into consideration when you're setting up a board game cafe. You need a big collection of games and those take space. Then you need tables that are maybe just for two people, but then also tables that are for bigger groups. And generally, like a table that you can play a board game on needs to be a bigger than your average bar table or a cafe table. And in addition to that, if you want to serve drinks or food, you need a bar or possibly a kitchen. So there's quite a lot of demand or a need for space compared to a cafe.
Yeah, from what I understood from the videos, and I'm now maybe paraphrasing and adding together some things, you do need a big space. Like you cannot have a small space. A small space will not generate the revenue that you need to keep like a board game alive. You need a big space because you need big tables that accommodate bigger games for hobby board gamers or for board games that are a little bit bigger. You indeed need a place to put the collection. You need a bar. You need a restaurant. Like you need a kitchen. The place needs to be bigger than your average cafe, for example.
First of all, we need to be in a big city or big enough city. We need to be close to a transportation hub.
Yeah.
Usually those kind of places are more expensive.
Yeah.
And then you need more space than an average cafe or a bar.
Correct. We were talking about the board game collection. How big should the board game collection be?
I have no idea about this. My guess is that it should be bigger than my personal board game collection. Maybe 200 games if they are well curated.
I guess it depends on the size and your specific kind of clientele, what they want to play. But Snakes and Lattice say that they open with, I think, 1,300, so 1,300 games, and then they expanded the collection of the first location to 3,000 games.
That's quite a bit more than a 200.
Yeah, that's quite a bit more. However, they said that for a new place that they were opening when they were recording these videos, and this is 10 years ago, they took away stuff that people were not playing, and then they instead managed to reduce it to apparently a very well-thought collection of 500 to 600 games.
Okay, that's nice to hear. It's like my 200 is not way, way off. I mean, it still should be two or three times more, but at least not 10 times more.
Yeah. And the way they did this is by basically just checking which games were played the most, like kind of having I don't know exactly what the internal logistics was it, but just they had a way of checking which games they were played the most. And instead of having a lot of games, they started curating the games that are played, took away the games that are not played at all, and bought 3, 4, 5 copies of games that are played quite a lot. All right, what should be the responsibilities of the staff in a board game bar?
I personally do not need a teacher at the location. if I would go to a place like this with my friends, either we might pick something that we know how to play, or in general, we would just pick a lighter game that we can learn on the spot without anyone teaching it to us.
Yeah, well, this is interesting because in order to make a business successful, you need the teachers. You need the, I think they call them gurus, like board game gurus or something like that in Snake and Lattice. But you need people that are able to teach games. Why? Because again, when they were mentioning the clientele that they have, they say that about 50% of the clientele are either people that are kind of semi-hobbies, but not really hobbies, like people that have played some games and want to explore more, but they're not the average hobby board gamer like you and me that they know exactly what they want, or people that just have played a few board games and want to know more. So they're like maybe going there on a date or they're going there with some friends, but they're not really haven't played that many. So their recommendations and the ability of a guru to teach games, it's what converts people that visit once that place into people that will visit the place multiple times and that will tell others. Now, there's the two extremes where like there's like the hobby board gamers. There are like another type of users that they see that they really don't need a board game guru. They know exactly what they want to play. They just want a place to test a game that maybe they don't know if they want to buy or not. And then the other extreme, like the people that got dragged by their partners or by their company or by some other force of nature that they're not really wanting to go there. And they don't care about board games and they don't care about being taught board games. They're just going to play things that they know and they have played maybe when they were kids, but they normally don't play board games. So those are the two extremes. But apparently at least 50% is people that need these board game gurus. So it might be a significant thing to consider if you're planning to open a board game bar. What do you think about drinks and food? Should you offer alcohol? Should you offer food in a board game cafe, board game bar?
I think board games are a great hobby because it's like a hobby where people can have a lot of social fun without any alcohol needed. Mm-hmm. You know, I think a lot of other social events might often need alcohol as like a social lubricant, mm-hmm. but I think games are social lubricant. They kind of like remove the need of alcohol. Having said that, I know a lot of people enjoy a beer or a nice cocktail while they are playing. So I think, yeah, a great board game cafe or bar should serve alcoholic drinks.
Yeah, and I think also part of it is that you need to make money. And I think having the alcoholic drinks are a great way for making revenue. Apparently, if you don't connect like the needs of the clientele, serve food for them, it's really hard to make a business out of just charging a membership fee, for example. You need to kind of have an extra source of income in order to supplement the rents of this hypothetical fancy location that you need to have your board game cafe at. Well, about that, Jonas, what do you think is the ideal board game fee or entrance? Should the board game cafe have a board game fee? And if so, how would the fee look like?
You know what? I actually did some research for mm-hmm. this. So I did not know that there is such a YouTube channel that explained these like economics of a board game cafe. So first of all, I'm like, so interested in like hearing all of this yeah. advice from the experts. So I went to check kind of like how much is their margin in a pint of beer that is sold, for example, in Helsinki. Mm-hmm. And based on like different numbers that I saw, it seemed that 60% of the price of the beer that you pay, that is taxes and the beer itself. And then 40% is the stuff that's left to, you know, pay for the space, pay for your employees, and, you know, to have a little bit of profit to take yeah. home. And then I was thinking that, okay, well, I wonder how many beers does an average person drink in a bar, let's say in 2 or 3 hours? And I thought that maybe it's around 3 beers, average number. And then, you know, thinking about the current prices in Helsinki, I came to a number of like, okay, maybe a single patron will leave maybe 9 to 10 euros for the bar to cover all of these other costs. And based on that, it just feels that, well, in a board game cafe or bar, the entry fee should be around 10 euros unless you're able to kind of like sell drinks to offset the costs.
Well, first of all, talking about prices in Helsinki, it's really expensive, like taxes and other stuff. Apparently making a big successful restaurant or at least a service industry business, it's harder than in other countries where like taxes and maybe other costs are a little bit less. Here also like the cost of hiring people is quite expensive. So for sure, making a business work in Finland, it's a bit harder than at least from what I know in Mexico, United States and Canada. This is again, from what I know, I'm not an expert, so please don't complain if you know differently, but that's from what I heard, like the margins are way lower in Finland than they are in other countries. That being said, at least Snake and Lattice 10 years ago used to charge $5, and they had been charging $5 for a long time. And the Drots plates, if I remember correctly,
Drots in London.
In London. Charge, I think, £8.50 for 3 hours.
I think I actually then went to check how much Drots charges, and it was £9.50 on peak hours.
£9.50 on peak hours. And on small hours, do you remember?
I think it was £7.50.
£7.50. Okay. Then I was like, £8.50 was the average. So according to Snake and Lattice, this money goes to maintenance, board game replacement, board game parts replacement, board game, like, just, it's an additional income, but it's not their main source of income. It seems like charging these $5 or $10 or whatever it is not necessarily something that will make or break your business, but it will definitely supplement the amount of money that you make through the food and beverages. Which, if we go back to the question, is like, do you need to sell food and beverages in order to make a business successful? Apparently, yes. You cannot just survive by having just a board game club and being able to sell memberships or entrance fees or something like that. That is not going to allow you to pay rent at all.
Does a average board gamer buy less drinks than a person who's in a bar to just drink and hang out?
I think so. I think on average, people tend to drink less, at least from my experience of going to different board game cafes and bars. If you're in a bar, people are drinking. People are there to drink and then to enjoy together. If you're playing board games, people maybe don't want to drink. They just want to play board games, and then they maybe buy one drink and then they stay with that drink for the rest of the night instead of in a bar, which is easier to just stand up and go for another one. Which makes a question is like, should you have a board game cafe that is mainly board games, or should you have a board game cafe that is mainly cafe?
That is mainly a cafe?
Yeah.
Board game second.
Yeah, exactly.
If I were to start a restaurant or a cafe or a bar, which first of all, I should not, because I know nothing about the business and the work itself is not particularly lucrative to me. But if I were to do it, I would pick a bar that it also has board games in it. Like, when you list the things or the economics of the board game cafe business, it's just like a big list of negatives. Again, you need to be in a big city. That's more expensive. You need to be located near a transportation hub. That's more expensive. You need a bigger space. That's more expensive. People will drink less at your place. That's less revenue. You need to get these gurus that teach people how to play board games. That's more costs, because I need to have those gurus and a waitering staff. It's just like all negatives.
Yeah. So yeah, like, the bottom line is, it seems that a board game cafe, board game bar business in Finland is not easy to pull off. In other places where it might be cheaper or easier to get profit out of a service business, it might be easier to get. However, I don't think it's impossible. I think if you manage to crack the membership fee, the cost of the things, maybe things need to be a bit more expensive. If you manage to attract the right people, I think it's doable, but it seems to be not the ideal business opportunity for somebody that wants to create a service business in Finland. However, I've also read online in Board Game Geek, some of the forums, where people just do it because they love board games. Mm-hmm. So it's like, is their side hobby? They actually have to pay to have it, but that also allows them to have a lot of board games that, yes, they have to share with people, but they just share the hobby of board game with multiple people. And that's kind of how they justify the extra costs for them. So what are, for you, Jonas, what are the main frustrations and downsides of the places that you currently go to?
They are too loud. There is EDM blasting from the speakers, way too loud. It's just like the wrong music for the, you know, the wrong atmosphere that you want for a board game night. There is bad lighting, which to me is just boggles my mind that a business that tries to get board gamers to come in to play board games doesn't have like proper lighting in it. It's just like the space is way too dim. Or if there's lights, they're focused so that oftentimes my head blocks a light behind me, mm-hmm. and I have to like move my head to see what's happening on the board. The tables are not great. They're too small most of the time. But that one I kind of can understand. I understand that, hey, you know, space is not free. Mm-hmm. But it's free to turn on the volume on the music. It's free to choose a different playlist. And it's the same amount of money to put on lights that are not these like super focused spotlights.
I think that goes back to, if you wanted to fix that, you would need to have a specified place with big tables, with good lighting, with stuff that is kind of catering for board gamers. So then you go back to the question, should board games come first or bar/cafe come first?
There are plenty of pubs in Helsinki that have a much nicer atmosphere, much better lighting. It's just even the tables are better for some reason at these pubs that don't need to cater for board gamers. So I think it is possible to, you know, do bar first and then also have a great space for board games.
Yeah. The main thing there, I think, would be with the maintenance and the curating of the games. If you're not focusing on it, then you're not including them in your costs. You just maybe have some board games on the side.
But if you are doing this as a passion project, then you usually you follow passionately about what is happening with board games. And, you know, you have this like extra interest to keep your collection up to date, even after business hours.
That is true.
Okay, my question to you. Trots in London. And the reason why we're talking about Trots so much in this podcast is that they have three locations.
Yeah.
Right. And we have both seen the Waterloo Station location, which looks super nice.
Yeah.
And London, I mean, London is a huge city.
Yeah.
There's no space anywhere. And for some reason, there is this board game cafe chain that is able to run three different locations that have nice space for nice, comfortable tables to sit around on and play board games while not spending as much money on drinks than you would if you would be just like in any other pub in London. What do you think is their secret?
Honestly, I think it's a combination of the rising popularity of the hobby, like people wanting to play more board games, even people that are not considered hobby board games, like on these two types that I said that are 50% of the people that come there, having good drinks and good food where like people are actually going there and then staying there for a little bit longer and then making it cool enough for people that are not hobby board gamers wanting to go there, playing whatever, like having a lot of maybe party games and simple games to teach. Like, I think that has to be the secret. It's like, you have to not cater for the hobby board gamers. If you cater for the hobby board gamers, you're not going to have a successful business. I do not know what their secret is. I think it's just like, maybe their prices are high. I have no, the place is huge. So they maybe make a lot of money on membership fee. They also have a lot of like, lot of drinks, lot of food being served all the time. So I think they managed to crack it as a business.
And I had a lot of complaints about the cost side of bars and cafes, but I didn't really talk about the revenue side. I kind of like just assume that it's easy to get a lot of foot traffic in your location. That's not easy. That's like a really hard thing to do. There's even in these locations that are close to transportation hubs, have the great location, they seem nice. And they just, you can see them going out of business every now and then.
Yeah. I think that's why the gurus might be super important. Like, you need to get people to come back.
Oh, yeah, and I'm not talking about board game cafes. Bars and cafes in general.
Yeah, yeah.
So, even though there is this baggage that comes on the cost side with the board game cafe business, you do probably get this boost in terms of, like, how well you are known around the area.
Yeah, I think if you manage to crack the code to make people have a fun, like, a good time at the place, they are willing to spend a bit more for the food and drinks in your place in order to cover the costs that having a bigger place in a nicer location with big tables that maybe don't allow you to accommodate as many people as a restaurant or a bar or whatever. So for sure, it's a tricky thing to do, but definitely achievable. I do not know if it's achievable in a city like Helsinki with the size of people. I think in London, in other cities where like the population is way higher, might be a fundamental part of making a business work. I don't know. Maybe at some point I'll start a board game cafe and tell you more about it, or bar. And that is it. That is all for today. We want to thank you for your time. Our next episode is airing in 2 weeks. In the meantime, you can visit BoardGameOK for more information about the show.
Moi moi.